Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
We're outside the Travel Agency, a cannabis store that's got everyone buzzing.
When I walked in, I felt like I was in the elite of the skies, like I'm about to get elevated and lifted in the best way. Got the important essential things. I need sleep, so tinctures, salves to relax my body, right? The best New York flowers.
Come down to the Travel Agency and see for yourself. For use only by adults age 21 and older. Keep out of reach of children and pets. In case of accidental ingestion or overconsumption, contact the National Poison Control Center. Consume responsibly.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
And I was on the live stream when this guy called, and he was like, hey, we just want to make a musical about you. And Martin just goes, fine. And that's it.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Scher.
Hello.
And Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It's director Brent Hodge, who's made a documentary called Pharma Bro. It's about Martin Shkreli. Remember that guy? Remember Martin Shkreli? It's on digital October 5th. Brent, welcome to the SinCast.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to know what you thought needed to be, you needed to probe the man Martin Shkreli more than you'd already heard on the news and everything. What inspired you to make a documentary about this guy who, you know, was for a while there like the most hated guy in the world?
He was coined, I think, 2016's most hated man in America.
Mm-hmm.
And he had stiff competition, by the way, in that year.
That's true.
He did. Who else was it? Trump? And
yeah,
there's so many of them, wasn't there? Mm-hmm. But you know, honestly, it's exactly what you just said. It's like, what made you want to do it? I don't think anybody was doing it right. If you go back into Google, a Google thing, and you start looking up Martin Shkreli 2015, start reading some articles, like nobody's getting this story right. They're not going deep enough. There's some like extremely lazy journalism going on. And I just like, there was so much missing. I kept sort of asking like, okay, we're talking about toxoplasmosis and Daraprim. Why does nobody talk to a patient? Like maybe we should talk to that instead of this weird CEO dude. Let's go down the Wu-Tang album thing. Why has nobody asked Ghostface? Why are we only seeing, why is TMZ the best interview with Ghostface right now? Like, what is happening? So I was more interested in that. And then I sort of stumbled upon this live stream of his where you're like, Martin Shkreli hasn't commented. He won't comment. He's this. We can't get a hold of him. He's brassed against any press. And you're like, what are you talking about? He's right here. I literally did one search. And his live stream would go all night, every night.
Wow.
And he'd give you his phone number and you could call. And you're like, this is insane. The one guy that everybody hates. I can actually ask him anything I want right now. That's a documentarian's dream. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of influence from films in my life, like especially documentaries. You look at Michael Moore's Roger and Me.
Right.
That was one of my favorites. Like he's on this quest to find the guy that can answer his questions. And I loved all that. I love how deep people can go. I love like these odd sort of documentaries that you can't script, Exit Through the Gift Shop or like Rachel and Heidi Who Did Jesus Camp. Like these are my favorite weird kind of movies and they really inspire me. And I was just going down this route with Martin. I'm like, fuck it. I'm getting my entire movie by calling in right now. And now he's telling us where he lives and I'm going to go further. I'm going to move into his apartment building and I'm gonna fucking get to know him and I'm going to see if this guy is exactly what I'm getting told, because people that are telling me are not telling me anything. They're literally telling me nothing. Headlines were like AIDS killer buys Wu-Tang album, uses it as coaster. I'm like, all right, what did he do? What did he do with the other 23 hours of his day? Like, they're giving me nothing. And so that was the inspiration of it all. Little did I know where it would all go. It went to a crazy place.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, Michael Moore is not moving next door to these people. So screw Michael Moore. I mean, you took that next step and you did it.
Mm-hmm. I did it. I will say, you know, he went to jail pretty early, right? Like, I get into his apartment building, his actual apartment room with him, and we're chatting, and I go on his live stream, which is like this weird Matrix moment where you cross over to the digital world.
Moment, by the way.
Yeah. And well, it was a really sort of tender moment where you're like, oh, okay, whatever facade has been put up by anything that this guy has presented to us, you can't take away the fact that I met you face to face. I at least get a reaction and the audience is with me. But I would say that was sort of like opening. I was hoping that was just going to be the opening to more. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to jail literally the next day.
Oh, wow.
So then there we are. And I'm like, well, what am I missing? Like, I have all these live streams, 500 plus hours recorded of live streams, met him a couple of times. What is this movie? Like, who is this guy? And getting Blumhouse was a big deal for me.
Yeah.
A really big deal. I sort of come off watching The Jinx. And I really love what they did with Robert Durst of like, odd sort of super villain dude. Can this story kind of change the trajectory of a trial? What is going on? And it was so scary to me, like scarier than any Blumhouse movie. And I love that. I was like, all right, we're making a horror documentary. Let's go. But let's get everybody. Like, if we're going to do this, let's get his lawyer and let's get Daryl Prem patients. Let's get Billy the Fridge. He's a troll. We got to hear the troll culture. Let's get Wu-Tang. We won't. This isn't done until I get everybody. And that was sort of like the journey of it, which is crazy.
Yeah. There's so many millions of things that we're going to talk about today. I don't even know where to start, but the first thing I want to say, the documentary makes clear that the price increase of Daraprim is not the only drug that's ever seen price gouging. There's just no laws against it in the United States. So why was he the face of this problem?
I mean, that's sort of crazy is he decided to be the face of it. Like, you know, it's funny, September 20th. So exactly 6 years ago, September 20th, 2015, literally 6 years ago today or yesterday, he confirmed like publicly that he raised the price of Daraprim by 5,000% or whatever it was, 5,500%. And you're like, why do you feel that you need to be the person? I mean, maybe it's an attention seeking thing. Maybe he was just thought it could be transparent. I really don't know. But yeah, you look at all these, like look at Questcore, they shoot up drugs. Look at Mylan that did the EpiPen. There's no like CEO that's in front of this going, hi everyone, I'm here to answer all your questions. Like, right. No. And then those people don't live stream. And those people also, that's what was fascinating about it. That's what I found so incredibly weird is like, you get a PR person. What the fuck are you doing, man? Like you watched a guy crash and burn in a way. And he like enjoyed it. It was so strange. But yeah, you're right. He's not the first person to do this. And he does not represent Big Pharma. He's a very small player in the game. And yet attention was on him like 6 years ago at this exact time. My God, I don't even want to know what September 21st, 2015 looked like for Martin Shkreli. That was wild.
Yeah. And the thing that maybe you can explain this to me, because this is something that I didn't get about. So this company, makes something that was $13.50, $750 a pill. But then they're like, well, whoever needs the drug is going to be able to get it. Everybody's got access to it. It's not a big deal. And then you even have the story of the one guy who asked a question on the Reddit AMA, who Shkreli ended up paying for all that guy's supply of this drug. So are people not getting this drug? Is that's for a fact, right? Does this drug sell much at all? What is the deal with this drug?
I mean, this is where you get into the copays and the insurance companies and all the loopholes that they have and how there can't be a generic version of it for a certain amount of years based off of the Orphan Drug Act. And like, we break it down to like, at least a minimal level in the film, because I feel like it's important to kind of explain it. But the reality is it kind of a bullshit system, and they found a loophole, and that's the way that the system works currently. Is there people that don't get the drug? I mean, I talked to a ton of patients on the phone, and this is the reality of it. And I thought we could openly speak and have them on camera. Like, someone who's sick doesn't want to go on camera. That was like a huge sort of lesson learned for me of like, not everybody wants to grab a megaphone and say their side of the story and be a victim to the system or anything. Some people are sick and they don't want to, they don't want to tell everyone in the world that they have HIV. They don't want to tell everyone they have toxoplasmosis. Like a really weird sort of, again, it's an orphan drug. It's like, it's a rare disease. So it's a bit odd how it affects certain people. Sometimes it affects them a lot and they lose eyesight, and other people, it has a connection to cats and pregnant women and cat litter. Like it's wild. This thing. And I will say that of everyone, the one public guy that comes out, Patrick Rice, he's in our film. I mean, what a weird story. He goes Reddit AMA and gets the drug because his gold plan wouldn't give it to him. He's whatever happened in this system, he had to go on AMA to get a hold of Skrilly. Like, that's not a business model. That's terrible.
That demonstrates the entire. I thought you did a great recap of the Orphan Drug Act and how that does expose, as well as I do at this point, like how these generic manufacturers like Retrofen, who bought out, this or Teva or any other sort of generic drug maker, make it for pennies. And all of it is profit, even at $13.50 is profit. And when you jack it up, then it's all profit. So yeah, when somebody does say, hey, can I get this? Sure. Because we're essentially getting it we bought it at cost. And yeah, I can give it to you. It's not coming out of my pocket. And it could help everybody that is afflicted with this, but yet there is no incentive for it. And Shkreli's vilified for jacking it up so much, but he's not wrong about the process, right? He's not doing anything illegal in this sense, right?
No, immoral maybe, unethical maybe, like nothing illegal. And he never even was really punished besides that opening thing that we have in the film where he's in Congress and they sort of make a statement about it. And he's like, totally jerked everyone. But like, why are they even having him there? Like, that's actually, why not just speak to him privately and actually do something about it instead of putting him on the stand? It was, the whole thing's really effed up. And I would say like, what I love the most about filmmaking is you kind of get these questions and you're like, why aren't we talking to a patient? Has anyone talked? Can I just go and like, I can literally just call a patient if I want. I'm a filmmaker and I'm inquiring. And that's where my curiosity went down. Like, I didn't know anything. I still don't really know anything about the pharma world, and I don't need to. The audience doesn't. So when I'm really happy that you enjoyed the breakdown of the Orphan Drug Act and everything, because that's coming from a Canadian, by the way. We have free healthcare, and I'm like, what is happening down there? And so for me to sort of have to break it down in the simplest form, it's still complicated, and I'm like, what is this? Yeah. And Skrilly becomes like a specimen of an experiment that is a movie. You're like, he's actually just specimen A, and he's kind of this weird dude, and he bought the Wu-Tang album, so like he fits in this wrinkle of pop culture and it works. But do you want to back up? Are we just talking about pharma? Are we just doing a very different film about pharma? And then what's the conclusion? Well, the conclusion is that out of all of this, the pill is still $750. What? Still to this day, right now, if you need Daraprim, it's $750 a pill.
Yeah.
Nothing changed. The only thing that changed is that time has passed and there is now there's eligibility for a generic version, which they've created. That's literally it.
I had read also that when that price was announced, that sometime later Skrilly wanted to reduce it, but the company sort of turned him down. Or is that just a myth of some sort that happened?
I don't know what happened with him and his companies after all this, because it's sort of unclear. I mean, like he had Retrofin and then he had Turing. Now Turing changed their name. They tried to get him out, but he's still like actively on the board. But now that he's in jail, he can't be. I don't quite, and then he started some other company and did some other, you know, another drug company. Like, it got a little blurry and unclear to me as I was going through of like, where are the companies at? And these companies, once the Shkreli thing happened, they weren't talking. I mean, I tried to go to one of the labs for Retrovin just to get to see somebody to talk.
Yeah.
To. That was my favorite moment of the film, by the way. I just
it was such a human moment of that interaction of, you know, I'm not going to be totally honest with you, but I'm going to be a little bit honest with
you. Yes, we're going to spit on him if he was here. And you're like, wow, yeah. That's okay. No. There's no PR person that wants to talk to you at all if you mention that person. To be honest, I think we're just going to take a break from PR until Martin Shkreli's name goes away. That's kind of what I got every time I talk to the drug companies. You know, but I would say like people who argued against Shkreli, we have a lot of different doctors and people who sort of are in this world and represent the toxoplasmosis community, whatever. Like they were in Judith Aberg, for example, she's in the film. These people were pretty open to talking, especially once Martin went to jail and they knew that they weren't going to get like trolls at them. They were very open to saying their opinions about this story and just America in general and where we're at with drug pricing.
Yeah. This documentary also touches on, I guess what you would call troll culture. And believe us, you know, we are, we made a name for ourselves by being tremendous trolls to movies and everything. So we understand all of that and everything. It's weird to me though, that this guy seems pretty likable, otherwise, but he's just such like, he's so outwardly a troll when he's in public and everything. How did you end up thinking about this guy by the time you got to the end of this movie?
Well, this is, you know, it's a journey of that too. I mean, what was wild was within two clicks on the internet, you could get to his live stream. And that was like, to me, a really sort of intimate place where enough people were there. But after a while, if you stay on all night and it's 4 or 5 in the morning, he's still awake and he's doing random stuff. He's giving finance lessons or he's playing guitar or he's answering his phone to random people asking him questions. Mm-hmm. He's sharing his screen. He's playing video games. If you stay long enough, people pretty much weed out and college kids that are bros like are like, I got a hold of them, they're out. And it's this like interesting depth of trolls and humanity. And if you can kind of sit there and then come back the next night and do the same thing and come back the next night, and we got 500 plus hours of that recorded, like I was really there. That's a weird world. The trolling world's weird. And talking to Billy the Fridge in the movie, pretty popular troll, he really sort of broke it down of like, it's a make-believe world that you can get to make up, and you know, it's entertainment and it's this, and it can harm people. It really can harm people, and they go for it, and that's brutal. But ultimately, there was something sort of calming about seeing Martin in that world, or just like existing there and recording there. You get answers to questions that you would never get if you put him in front of a camera and put spotlights in front of his face in a Hollywood studio. It just wouldn't have happened. And I sort of like gained a different and new respect for trolling, where I'm a Canadian. So before I was like, this is just pure nihilism. This is negative. Like we are happy. We say sorry and we are happy to be here. And like, and I was so confused on what this was and why it why people care and why it exists. And I'll say that I learned a little bit more of the depths of it and maybe the support of it. Nobody else is supporting Martin. So where does he turn to? Right. It's like that moment in the Joker at the end of the movie, Todd Phillips version, right? Where like the ambulance or whatever he was in crashes and they like lift him up. I was like, whoa, this is insane. And I'm like, you're going to find people that love you and hate you. And what Martin's found here is the people that love him. Like, and I can't argue with that. They love him for whatever reasons and they get the support for whatever reasons they get from him. It's about as real as it gets though, in terms of conversations, it's bullshit. They're just having bullshit combos. And like some people on there are like wearing masks and they got guns. And some people on there are just galling and trolling. It's really strange. But I will say, like, it was, there was something oddly calming about it. And I got a lot of quotes and material from my journey that I needed from those live streams.
Yeah. You said something to the effect that you had watched so much footage at that point. You were out of it or something, you know, like, I can't imagine having weeded through all of that, just constant, like, you know, live stream stuff. I mean, it must have been you must have just been exhausted at the end of it.
Yeah, and I'll say, like, it takes a village to make a documentary. It's not one person, you know. And if anyone says that they make the film by themselves, and I'm sure they've had help. There was a, you know, I have a great team of people that were helping me. There's no way you could stay up all night on these live streams. We'd do some shift work, and we would have different people help. Editors would go in and kind of mark parts for me. We would, like, bin them and figure it out. But, like, the difference between this film and others, like, there's no budget. There's no call sheets. There's nothing. We're just, we don't know what's happening next. That's a true documentary. It was really exciting and different. A little bit of a slow burn, though, because not a lot happens in real life. You know, like, you sort of accumulate 5 years and you're like, okay, we have enough for a 90-minute movie, but not a lot happens in one evening when you're watching a live stream. Maybe nothing. That's hard. Watching this guy play chess. This is the worst night of my life. Overall, I mean, yeah, that's why we sort of took it to the next level too. And we're like, all right, let's move into his building. He's saying where he lives. Let's go. He's saying, call me. He's saying, do this. Fine. Let's go. Let's try this stuff. Let's do more. Let's go deeper. Let's go further. Let's go to Skrell, Albania. Let's, like, meet this, like, let's start from the beginning. Then what?
Yeah.
He's in Brooklyn. Okay. And how do you get hedge funds? Okay. What is the Orphan Drug Act? Why has no one talked to Wu-Tang? And you start to do it and you're like, this is really entertaining. Like, in the end, this is extremely entertaining, kind of funny, kind of scary movie.
I just look at the guy who is, you know, who would be behind, jacking up the price of this really life-saving drug compared to the guy that we see behind the scenes. Like, I feel like there's a moment in this movie that's fairly, it's not innocuous. It's your first time you meet him. He seems just like a normal dude throughout this. And then, you know, and then giving that guy his drug supply and all this, and, like, saying that he wanted to put, you know, buy a house for his mom and all this. And, like, you know, is that part of him, is that part of him, I don't know, kind of, it seems like he has struggles within himself. Like, you would think that a guy like that would be upset that he's behind that kind of a price gouging type of thing.
I know. This is where it's like, you know, the quest to kind of figure him out socially, of, like, where his stance is. And he says this sort of, like, I want to buy my mom this, or, like, talks about that. But then he buys, like, the domain name of some journalist, which is, like, pure harassment. Like, what a weird sort of, like, power quest. I don't know if there's, like, I don't have all that much, like, sympathy for some of the good things he did. I'm more like, some of the moves he made are, like, really wrong, and then some are like pretty genius. Like, the Wu-Tang album buying thing and the idea of that and his explanation of that, he was explaining, remember this, he said, like, I think he wrote it was like a blog post or something, he wrote, you know, the music industry is only $50 billion, like, the entire industry. And that's, like, some less money than some companies make. Like, that's how small this thing actually is. It has a huge impact, but it's so small, like, financially. And we don't really see that. And yet we also have a problem with buying a piece of music. Like, we won't purchase music. And there was just, like, when he did that, I was like, holy cow, you just, like, really put your money where your mouth is on this one. And you, like, put it out on the line to put a value on something that's kind of weird and outrageous. And, like, I don't know, like, I hadn't heard of Wu-Tang in a little bit. Like, they're obviously legends, but I was like, what? I didn't even know that this was going on, and you have this thing and you're not letting anybody listen to it, and you're being a troll in that respect. That was a pretty bold move. But then he flips it and he's like, I'm using it as a coaster with, like, all the money I made from drugs. You're like, dude, right. Stop it. Like, you had me for a second. You really had me. And then I guess that's trolling, right? I guess that's, that's sort of the art of it. I sort of had that idea of like, can we out troll the troll? Can we like get to know him and he actually has some, like, is there a friendship there? Can we like put everything aside and just have a beer together? That's the ultimate hit. And Billy the Fridge says it in the movie. Like, if you get to know him, like, you've got him. And you try. Maybe we didn't get to know him. I mean, you know, maybe I have no idea. That when you're on a live stream, is that just a persona of you? Like, is it all I know is I met him and I looked him in the eyes and that's all I got. And the audience was with me. So we got as close as anybody else did, I guess.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Tell us about your comic book theme in this movie, because you have a thread going through here where, you know, people are comparing him to a comic book supervillain. But what the comic book, guy is telling us is that, you know, supervillains are, you know, tend to have, you know, they have that one trait or whatever, they're evil and that's about it. And like, can you really compare Martin Shkreli to a comic book supervillain? Talk about that theme that you, when did you come up with that theme and how did you know that you were going to put it in the movie?
I think the media helped me with that one. They were just calling him the most evil man in America and supervillain. And he was even sort of saying like, I will be your Bond villain. If that's what you think and I'm evil, let's do it. Travis, he's a psychologist who's in the film. He really sort of, amped it up and kind of like, I think he wrote an article that I hit and I was like, oh, I'm going to talk to you on the phone. Can we like see if Martin Shkreli fits all these? And he knew everything about Martin and it obviously follows the news and pretty much anybody who puts themselves in like an evil light. Martin, a lot of the time on these live streams, is like pretty obsessed with wrestling as well. There's a whole wrestling theme. The few times where he like live streamed from SmackDown and you know, the idea of having that like sort of, undeveloped sort of like good versus evil was quite prominent in how he like responded to people. He'd call, like people would call in and it would be like the nicest guy, and then within a minute he would switch and be a jerk to the next guy, and then he'd be nice and you don't know which one you're getting. I think it got developed sort of organically through that, and then we really dissected it at like a psychology level and sort of a pop culture level with actual comic books, the actual villains that we know. Like, how is he like the Penguin? Why is he like the Joker? You know, you know, and the Riddler, we just go through all of them. And then you started weirdly seeing that he would compare himself in interviews like that. And we put these in the movie, like he's on TMZ and someone said, you feel like, I feel like you think you're like a Lex Luthor. And I was like, what the hell? I just thought about that. And so it started to kind of piece together almost perfectly. And even the way that the Wu-Tang clash happened, it's all kind of in this odd make-believe world. Blumhouse is a big, you know, example of that. They've done a few films in this world and they're doing Spawn. And I liked that a lot. And when they came on board, they were the perfect partners in a lot of ways. I got a lot of influence from the Jinx. They put the Jinx out a few years right before we started, and just Robert Durst and this idea of who he was and how the film kind of gets to know him and you make your own conclusions. I just thought Jason Blum jumping into the doc world was just so genius. And I got a lot of influence from their films as well on how they broke down. What's the other one? They did Spawn. They've done Spawn, but it was, it's the one, I think it's called Unbreakable. Maybe I'm wrong. It's like Bruce Willis and who else is in it?
Samuel L. Jackson.
But, yeah, that's the one. You know the one, right? And there's
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Or they did like the second version of that. And anyway.
They did Glass and Split and that's all that. Right. Yeah.
Glass. There was always a comic book theme, which I liked. I just like this idea of comparing it to what we know in pop culture, because whether we like it or not, he was sort of, you know, getting, he was kind of embedding himself in culture. Like, we didn't have a choice. he bought the album. As soon as he bought that album, I was like, he's now different. This isn't just a person who can get a PR company to take this over. He's here. He's arrived. Mm-hmm. We have no choice.
Yeah. Kind of. I mean, and is it no doubt in your mind that because of all of this, this is why he got investigated for securities fraud?
I mean, you know who knows the most about that is the farmer bro, the journalist who fell in love with the farmer bro, Chrissy Spite. Who I just talked to, by the way. We did a one-on-one interview for her publication, which is pretty cool. I haven't talked to her since our interview, but she sort of knows more about the dates of all that. She like, but yes, I mean, absolutely. I would say the attention that he put on himself and put himself in the spotlight attracted an FBI investigation. There's no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, it seems obvious, but you never know, right? I guess. I mean, it's always a question. You have to actually be in the FBI or something to know that.
Yeah, I mean, we would have never heard about it if he wasn't popular. I'll tell you that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So FBI go after a lot of people all the time, but we would have never heard about it. But I don't know how all that really went. Like the timeline gets a little confusing for it. You know, it's like, I think I don't know if he bought the album at that point, but he was definitely going to be or was under investigation.
I remember that all converging at the same time. When, of course, you know, who knows? My memory is probably bad on this, but it seemed like all of that came around the same time.
It happened really quick, too. I mean, you're talking like between September 20th, 2015, a year, like 6 years ago exactly. And the next year, he was deemed the most hated man in America by like the next year. It was a crash and burn. And, you know, he just kept answering questions, kept going on those live streams. It was insane.
I mean, he was on pace to be the next Milo Yiannopoulos, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
How is that? By the way, how is that guy behind the scenes?
I mean, I don't know. Honestly, I don't.
Like, you can talk bad about him. You're in a safe place.
Oh, I happily talk bad about Milo. But like the behind the scenes is like, I don't actually know because he just came in, sat down, did his interview and left. I would love to sit here right now and say, yep, he hung out and we were in Florida and we had a beer and I actually got to ask him about some issues and some things. Like I didn't get any of that. I got the camera version of Milo, which I actually thought was pretty good. And he dove into, you know, supervillain elements of it and like troll elements. I thought his interview was very necessary for this film. He was also doing a lot with Martin at the time. Like he was, they were doing those live talks and different things. So it was kind of this weird moment, but like, yeah, I don't know what he's like behind the scenes. I don't care what he's
He brings up one of the more interesting points, though, when he says that, you know, one of the things about Martin that's hard to figure out is we know what he hates, but you don't really know what he's advocating for.
I love that. I absolutely love that part. And it's so true. And that was sort of the question for him was like, okay, you guys seem to be on the same train together, whatever you want to call this train. What's the difference between the two of you? And the difference is like he knew exactly what he was wanting, where – He kind of compares Martin to like to punk rock, right? To like nihilism, and not in a sexy way, like in a like crash and burn kind of way. And I don't know if there's an ultimate goal out of it besides pure nihilism, which is really scary, really kind of scary, right? That's where it gets. Mm-hmm. That's where this becomes a horror film, where like you look into Milo's eyes and he's scared and doesn't understand the motive. You're like, okay, this is weird.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this goes back to like, I wanted everybody from Wu-Tang to Milo to this love interest journalist, Chrissy Smythe, to his lawyer. I wanted everybody. Like, that to me is a documentary. Like, let's get all sides of this. Let's not just get a headline that tells me who he is. Let's get them all.
I've never seen anybody more satisfied with what he's just said than Milo Yiannopoulos.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really, truly don't know. And I don't even know if they're like, are they even pals? That was like,
yeah.
I'd love to know if Milo even, has he contacted Martin? Has he said, you know, I hope you're doing it? I have no idea. No clue. Mm-hmm. And I bet the answer is probably no.
Since you brought her up, you have this kind of interesting, I guess, twist, you know, that I definitely didn't see coming there at the end with the journalist. Did you know that going in? Did you know the relationship aspects?
What's the date today? September 21st, 2021. Yeah. Okay. So I did that interview with Chrissy Smythe like 4 years ago. Like I'm talking like 0%. I did that interview with a journalist at Bloomberg who's covered a lot of Martin Shkreli's stuff. And just like I have a journalist from the New York Times, a journalist from Elle Magazine and New York Post. I just wanted like an array of journalists. I was also sort of curious that like she's a journalist that's gotten quite close, but he doesn't own her domain name. He was buying everybody else's domain name. The one thing that really prompted me to want to do that interview is I had heard that she somehow got the rights to write his book. And I was like, you got the rights to write Martin Shkreli's book? And she's writing a book called Smirk. Great name. Great for a book. I don't even know if that's going to be the full title or what. And so I wanted to talk to her. So I met up with her in Brooklyn, and I just wanted to know, like, how do you get access to Martin Shkreli? How do you get his book rights? Like, how did this go down? And we chatted, and I didn't get really any inclination of any of it. I just thought she was a journalist. But she did know a lot about him, but I'm just some journalists are really good at their job. They know a lot about people and people that they've had to cover in court and different things. And then I did an interview with her. The first sort of lower third on her on our movie was Chrissy Smythe, author of Smirk, Bloomberg journalist. And then this whole thing changed. It was crazy. Then you go back to your Raw interview and you realize that your instincts are probably spot on. And I asked her in the interview, I'm like, I can't tell if you like him or not. And she's like, I don't know if I do either. I did leave that interview with like a little bit of a hint of like, I didn't think they were going to be in a relationship in jail. This is crazy. But I did have sort of an inclination. When we went to the courthouse, when his trial was on, I remember walking in and journalists were all to the left and everybody, you know, they place people. And I looked over and I remember seeing Martin Shkreli's parents there and she was sitting next to them. And I was, And I was so confused. And I was, I remember going, why? So I knew that she had a different relationship with Martin, but she was married. So I didn't assume any of this. I will say the story coming out didn't shock me, but it did, help our movie a lot.
It was amazing.
It really did. And I won't even say that from like, only not from a story perspective, just from Martin was kind of out of the news for a hot minute. He seems to come back in cycles, but when you're selling a movie and when you're trying to get it out to the world, you want that cycle to hit exactly when your meetings for your sales are. And it did.
Yep.
So it was kind of like, whoa, this guy isn't going away, is he? And you're like, no, he's actually as popular right now as he was 5 years ago, and jail has not stopped any of this. So that kind of pushed us over the edge and actually got this film like an air date and got us out. So I actually thanked her today. I think I'm supposed to thank you. The book's funny because I got a little bit of an update on the book of like she's actually like scrapped it for now. She's going to put it out, but she's not. She doesn't know what the intent or the sort of objective is anymore. I was like, wow.
I imagine it started one way. And as soon as she fell in love with him, she was like, I don't know if I can be, you know, impartial about this anymore.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, all I know is that I thought I went deep and she went way deeper. Like she, that's the story of like Chrissy Smythe in our film is that she did an interview and I definitely got this sort of, like head scratch moment. I truly remember like sound guy and the DP and me were like, what does she do? Like I was like, she's a journalist, but she knows him. She's writing his book. She knows him quite well. They're like, yeah, she like really knows Martin. Like that's probably the most in-depth interview of anybody that knows him. And like backed him up. And then you guys know the story as it unfolded, but yeah, that's all I kind of knew about it. It's just weird when you look back at Raw interviews. So So we did sort of change the ending of our film to make sure that's included.
When you and then you start, when you hear that, that bomb gets dropped, you think back to like, there's like, you asked her at one point, like what she thought of the women in his life. And she just kind of gives like, it's almost like at the time I didn't think anything of it, but now that I think back about it, she kind of just, she's like, you know, I mean, they were, you know, they were reasonable to talk to or something like that. Like that's her answer. It was just such an odd answer.
Yeah. And I actually said to her today, I said, were you guys dating when we did our interview? Like, were you, and she said, no, like I was going through my journey and process of it all as well. So you're like, okay, well, you definitely answer. I agree with you. Like there was definitely some answers that, it is so funny looking at raw footage. I mean, this must be what it's like to look at raw footage of like Muhammad Ali now, you know?
Yeah.
You get like a Muhammad Ali quote and you're like, maybe he wasn't even trying to like have like an inspirational quote, but it was just something he said and we've turned it into like a mural on a wall. Like it's really kind of a fun process going back into your films and seeing raw footage.
I imagine so. You may have touched on this, but how long was it when you were doing, how long were you doing this before you finally, I guess, got the courage to meet him and then ultimately to go up to his actual apartment? How long did it take you to do that?
I'd say maybe a year process of that, like that sort of journey of like, we have done these live streams as long as possible. What's next? What's exciting to me now? What is he doing that's exciting? Because I can't watch another finance lesson. What is it? And he's like, come find me, come see me. You're like, well, here we go. You know, it was kind of that. That was a year process. And honestly, like I said, I really think I was the opening to like, then he went to jail really fast, like within 24 hours. Going up to him, there was an event. It was a Milo event. I was so weird. That whole process, that was a really weird kind of like moment in a culture that I think a lot of humans, like it was a combination of like Trump supporting Proud Boy, the whole works. It was like, right. What is this? All I know is this is a really kind of creepy event and negative, but I knew if I didn't leave that event without at least saying, it was about as immediate, like I had to say hi to him. It was like, there was some immediacy there. I don't remember between then, like it's kind of a blur between then and going up to his apartment, but there was some time that passed for sure. I mean, there's 5 years here, you know, we went and made other projects and other stuff. I wasn't always there every second. You'd go crazy if you did. So, you know, like we're on the road a lot making films. So I know we had to go like even within the next week and then came back.
I mean, I imagine you were worried about like, you know, possibly meeting him and then him shutting you down immediately and then you not knowing what to do anymore. I bet it took a while for you to get that courage to do that, right?
I mean, it was just this really crazy movie where I didn't have any script or like any moments planned out. I didn't even know how it was going to end. I kind of figured there could be something around the trial. You know, he was always going to have this trial in a little while, that I knew, but, no, like I just knew I really wanted Wu-Tang in it. Right. I really knew that. I really knew. I wanted Ben Brafman. I wanted his lawyer. I think that his lawyer is a really odd, kind of well-spoken individual as well. It represents a lot of like villains in the world. Like he's got a crazy kind of track record of that too. And people who aren't villains, by the way, he represented Jay-Z and P. Diddy and stuff. And you're like, why aren't they? They were almost in the same. Okay. All right. This is weird. But I didn't have anything. Like I didn't have any plan. That's what was extremely, freeing, but also like chaotic about this film is putting it together. You're like, what did we just get last night? Where does that even fit? It was an interesting way to make a film. I also had to get over the fact that like not every documentary has to, you know, like save the universe. Like it was just right. Like they don't all have to make you turn vegan or, you know, right. tell a biopic or save the dolphins. Like we don't have to do that. You just have to experience. And if it's entertaining enough, an audience will watch it. And I truly think we accomplished that. This is extremely entertaining. There's no way that you can take your eyes off of this car crash of a,
yeah,
like a situation. And you're going through it through my eyes, which I think is really important versus just the headlines that were out there and the journalists speaking on it. I think there's something about having me kind of guide through it that people can relate to, I hope.
I'm sure he's aware of this documentary at this point. Have you heard anything about him? Has he said anything?
I was just talking to Chrissy Smythe about that. Like, you know, does he want to see it? But I never made it for Martin, right? I made this
right.
To sort of explain the Martin that we all know and get a little deeper on it. But I don't know because I haven't talked to him. I can't talk to him in prison. So I'm not totally sure where he's at with it. Also, like, I don't really care. Like it's mm-hmm. a bit of that. I don't know if he cares.
Yeah.
And if he does care, great. And if he likes it, fine. If he doesn't like it, fine. Like there's a bit of that.
Well, yeah, you have that actor who's in the musical in there. Who's like, you know, it was like, you believe how insane it is that, you know, we're talking about how I feel about playing him in a play. And like, you know, he probably loves that, that all this attention that's being focused on him and everything. How was that musical, by the way? Was that fun to watch?
That's pretty funny. So the musical starts, it opens up with a phone call from the director of the musical. And I was on the live stream when this guy called and he was like, hey, we just want to make a musical about you. And Martin just goes, fine. And that's it. It's a great opening. It's just like the curtains go down and the lights go down to black and they just play the phone ringing and then it's up and then they go all over and they have a lot of fun. And, you know, Wu-Tang comes in at some point. Like it's a really fun musical. And yeah, it's just jokes. It's literally a bit of trolling and a lot of comedy and a lot of stupidity. And I just felt that guy was so funny and he played really, really well. And I was like, all right, let's get like a meta version of this. And that line where he's like, Martin would love probably soak this up and love this. And you're like, I don't even care.
Yeah.
I don't even care if I like it. So I don't care. I'm enjoying this process. And I know the audience is going to be too.
Anything else for you guys?
Yeah, Brent, I have one serious question and one not so serious question. Which one do you want first?
either one, actually. I'm good. Either one. Okay. Non-serious first.
Non-serious first?
Oh, wait. No. Serious first. This is the way you're
supposed to do it, right? Serious first.
Yeah.
I have to ask why or if you made an attempt to reach out to Lauren Duca for the interview and how that's obviously a very delicate subject matter to handle. What are your thoughts on whether we explored this enough, whether, you know, the danger that was presented to her was obvious enough to really merit a large section of it. And so it sounds like you did reach out to her for comment at least.
Yeah, I did. And I got on a phone call with her. I tried to interview her like 3 or 4 times and she was like, I'm happy to talk about my experience and go through this. I think women should hear this. It was more like, I don't want any more attention from any of his followers though. Like if my name is in a sentence online again with his, like this is actually starting to go away and I don't have to have 24-hour security around me and like, you know, all this stuff. I was like, whoa, this is real. She goes, oh, this is ruining my life, completely ruining my life. So it got real. That was not a joke. And that part's really fucked up. You know, and for anyone who's listening, doesn't know, like just Google Lauren Duca and Martin, but essentially it was trolling to its nth degree. It was harassment and it wasn't necessarily coming from Martin. He would have some jokes and play it up, but it was the followers that followed behind that really made her life hell. Based off of journalism that wrote bad crap about him. It wasn't even that bad. So like that got a little freaky. I did talk to her. I did try to get her in the movie. I told her I'm going to play that one part in the movie that she does. I think she did it on Teen Vogue or something. She did this sort of piece. Yeah, I got serious. And you know, consequences came. He was kicked off of Twitter because of it, and it was brought up in the trial along with all the other domain names that he bought of people. Like that's a weird shit. Like, what a weird sort of like internet power move, you know, if you want to say the drug thing is the drug thing, you know, we explain it, I think, as well as possible in the film. But if you want to look at the two sides, I think the Wu-Tang part of things is pretty genius on his part. I think the female journalist thing is really screwed up. Like,
yeah, it is.
So eerie.
Well, that's where you talk about a horror movie. You know, when you look at the harm that somebody like Milo Yiannopoulos and Ciccarelli have done on a practical level, you know, yes, they are caricatures and they're well-formed caricatures, but is there an implicit, and I don't mean this to sound pejorative because I did very much enjoy the movie, but is there an implicit kind of sign off on this by you being so impartial to the trolling, to being so observational of it, rather than being so condemning of it?
I know what you're saying. And I'm like, if I'm having to be impartial about everything, I have to be impartial about it all. It's like this weird, I do sort of hit it with my opinion in those parts. Like I sort of face Billy the Fridge and say, I don't think he understands the damage he's done. And it's like, well, what damage has he done? And you're like, what do you mean? Like there is a bit. So there is conflict. But I don't have the conclusion either. So that's the hard part.
Right.
I mean, if I was in a position where I actually had a conclusion to how this could be solved or how it could be different or like that, I don't think it'll take, I hope it doesn't take too many people to realize that's wrong, you know? And we just play it out. You play it out with what happened. What did the world do? Well, the world brought it up in trial and the world kicked them off Twitter and like, all right, well, we're just going to leave it at that, I guess. It becomes a blip in this big, large story, which sucks.
Because the whole narrative is based on this caricature and not the individual actions and especially how it hits, you know, the people in that radius, right?
If you could have like commentary, if you could have a moment where you go, where you can pull away from the film, almost like a Shakespearean moment, you can like pull it and go, I just want to remind everyone that this was end of 2015, 2016. Me Too movement hadn't happened yet. We hadn't had cancel culture. We just want to let you know that the impact of this moment probably and hopefully with the learnings that we've had over the last few years would have changed or been more direct towards Mark. Thank you. And like back in the movie, like I would love to have that aside, but you're kind of a weird aside to have. I think that the times, oddly, even though it was a few years ago, are different. And, you know, I really do hope that they've stopped and like that this film doesn't recreate any. I would absolutely hate if this film brought a trolling element attention to these journalists again, because that's wrong. And that's not the
right point. I appreciate that. I know. And it's got to be hard to be an impartial documentarian in a situation that's so emotionally charged like this, right?
Yeah.
Where you, especially something that you've devoted a substantial amount of your life to, moving in and, you know, looking through this footage and things like that. But I do respect that you remained as observational as possible.
Sure.
Even though you tried to interact with this guy on a personal level, it's all for the service of, you know, the story of what you see. And that's gotta be hard though, right?
I mean, it's hard, but I can make it extremely clear that I think he's a fucking asshole. Like it's, you know.
Hey, there's the pull quote right there. That's all you need.
I hope that comes across too. I think in the end, it's sort of like, I don't know how I feel about this guy. I didn't really know how I felt about him before, but I have gone through my journey and like, conclusion, you can go to jail for being a total asshole. Like that's the reality of it. Did he do anything wrong in the farmer world? No. Like morally maybe, but not legally. Okay, fine. Like he's where he is because of how he acted and reacted. Like, he knows that. Like, this guy's fucking smart. Like, and so I think that doesn't mean that he doesn't have the ability to do great things and he doesn't have the ability to come out of jail and do great things. I don't think that I think there's a possibility there. Whether the world will accept it, who knows? I mean,
I gotcha.
He's a great example of, you know, it doesn't matter how much good you can find out of him. There's a lot of bottom line evil shit that this guy's done. And, you know, it's like, yeah, you might be a nice guy, but you still jacked up the price of these pills. Yeah, you might be. He does say I'm not a nice guy in one of the streams.
Yeah.
But still, like, if you find anything good about him, there's still a lot of bottom line stuff. That trolling stuff, man, it's like, you know, they don't seem to understand the damage that's caused, because they're just, in their eyes, it's funny to them that they're doing all this stuff. And they don't see the other side of the wall, where there's all these followers who come in and just ruin people's lives. They don't see that part of it. So
no, I mean, I don't know, like maybe he does now. Maybe he sort of had a moment to reflect on it. I don't know. I don't really like, I don't know where his brain is at with that, but you're exactly right. Like, there is literal quotes from him. They're on camera that he recorded for our purposes that show him. I don't even know if that's the real him, though. Like, is he just playing into the Bond villain thing? Like, do you really think that? Because he also gives a lot of money to philanthropy and do that. So that was kind of the amazing part about this, is like, if anything, in anything I learned, is like, maybe an evil persona or evil character isn't one dimensional, and that's kind of great. There's a lot more layers to that, you know, but still, I think there is a conclusion. I think I was impartial, but I can still say that, like, that journey and the experience of that, like, my mind wasn't changed. This person did a lot of things that aren't right.
Mm-hmm.
I gotcha. All right. So I said, this is a non-serious question, but this is a very, very serious question. This is the last thing I'll ask.
Okay.
What the fuck is that thing at the bottom of Billy the Fridge's chain? Is that like a French cruller?
It's a donut. Yeah, it's like a honey cruller, like a donut.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is, it's remarkable. I want it. I was so distracted. The guy's very magnetic and very talented at whatever he does, but I could not take my eye off of that.
What does he say? He's like a 500-pound puppy dog, or what? He says something like that, right?
He's a 500-pound sex symbol.
That's
he's
right.
Marilyn Monroe of fat dudes. Kind of no sense. Billy the Fridge. You know, go follow him now. He's very much Billy the Mini Fridge now. He's lost a ton of weight.
What? Come on.
Yep.
He's busting his whole brand.
Yeah.
He's going to hate seeing this, man.
I loved interviewing Billy the Fridge. It's one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. I just thought he's just so real. And it took a little bit of time. Like, that was after Martin went to jail. And he was like, no, I'm not doing interviews with, I don't care what movies you've made and if they're funny, like, we're not doing that. And then eventually he was like, fine, let's, you know what? I'm going to do it. And it was just so real and phenomenal and like genuine. And he veers on the other side. He thinks the journalist stuff's funny, and he's like, Lauren who? Oh yeah. Like, he jokes about it, and you're like, no man. Like, there was contention, but also, just sort of like some understanding from both of us. It was really, really great to interview him.
He's got a sick donut chain too.
Well, it looks like we are running into our time limit here. Brent Hodge, thank you so much for coming on the Sincast and talking about your movie.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Farmer Bro, October 5th. It's out in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, he said it. I was going to say it, but he said it. That's awesome, man. Comes out on the digital platforms, basically. Is that what it is? Digital platforms?
Yeah, it'll be everywhere. And the 1091 Blumhouse, like, you Google this film, you'll find a place. It's going to be everywhere.
Yeah. All right. We'd like to thank Brent for giving us his time. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson, Barrett Sher, and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.